Hey, Tacoma. What's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully and sometimes optimistically. My primary goal in these programs is to take as clear-eyed and non-ideological as possible look at where we are and where we're headed with our climate in particular and our environment in general. With each passing year, it becomes clearer and clearer that we are not going to stop fossil fuel pollution in time to avert catastrophic climate change. We might, but right now and into the foreseeable future, we are emitting worldwide more and more fossil fuel pollution year over year, and we're seeing the predicted results of that pollution in the form of climate change. So if we are to avert the bad place to which we are headed climate-wise, one of the proposed tactics is geoengineering, a focus being placed on shielding, to an extent, radiation from the sun reaching the surface of the Earth and possibly artificially pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Today, we're privileged to have Dr. James Konka talking to us once again about climate change, and this time about the ins and outs of geoengineering, primarily from a scientific perspective, but also from a politics and policy perspective. Dr. Konka is a scientist environmentalist with 33 years specializing in, amongst other things, geological disposal of nuclear waste and energy-related research. He's a trustee of the Herbert Parker Foundation, which is associated with Washington State University, and he's also adjunct faculty there. He's been a consultant for the Department of Energy and the EPA and for state environmental agencies, and he's consulted with companies on topics of nuclear power, hydro, wind farms, large solar arrays, and coal and gas plants. He was a project leader at the Los Alamos National Lab. Right now, he's a regular science writer for Forbes magazine. He's had membership in a number of environmentally concerned organizations over the last decade: Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund. He's got a PhD in geochemistry from Caltech. So a distinguished scientist, and we are fortunate to have him talking with us today. So let's listen in. Well, greetings, everybody. We're happy to have Dr. James Konka with us today. Dr. Konka, welcome.
Thank you so much for letting me come.
Yep, looking forward to our conversation. Dr. Konka, of course, has got a resume, I could say as long as my arm, but it's actually longer than my arm. And he's an extremely busy guy, so we are blessed to have him with us here today to share his expertise on this most important subject of what's the future of our climate and what are we going to do about it. So if you would just start us off, Jim, by sketching out very briefly what's going on with the climate and why, and we'll leave the and what to do about it till later. But what's going on with the climate and what's causing that?
Well, one of the problems that humans have been causing since they became probably the most important species on the planet for a long, long time is that we affect the planet as a whole now. I mean, there's almost 8 billion of us. We move more Earth every year than plate tectonics. That just awed me when that happened in the 1980s. And so we affect so much that nothing goes unaffected. And so the atmosphere is no exception. We've been dumping a lot of stuff into it, not just CO2, but mercury and coal particulates and things like that. And it's become a problem in terms of greenhouse gases. Now, greenhouse gases, all that means is that it allows UV light from the sun to pass through it, hit the surface, which it re-radiates as infrared, as heat, and that blocks it. So certain compounds like CO2 and methane and other GHG gases, they are opaque to infrared and they are transparent to UV. And so what that means is that heat that usually gets out does not get out. Okay, and so it heats up the atmosphere a little bit, which then heats up the oceans a little bit. And the oceans are a huge sink for temperature because water is, has amazing properties with regard to heat. And it's the ocean temperature heating that is really more important than the atmospheric heating because that lasts a long time. and it affects ocean life. You know, it just affects a lot of things. Now, besides temperature, CO2 in the atmosphere also dissolves in water in the oceans and on land. The higher the CO2 content, the more dissolves in the water, and that causes carbonic acid to form, and that reduces the pH, lowers the pH of the water. And the pH right now of the oceans is in balance between calcium carbonate that organisms precipitate and the CO2 at about 350 parts per million in the atmosphere. Now, if you start putting a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, it dissolves in the ocean, reaches an equilibrium in only about 4 days, so it's pretty fast, and that drops the pH. If it drops, and it's in some places it has dropped below 8.3, and if it drops below that, then small organisms that secrete calcium carbonate shells, tests as they call them, can't do it, or it's ratty. Okay, the calcium carbonate isn't very strong, and that's the base of the food chain. And so you disrupt the whole food chain that way. That's also one reason why coral reefs bleach, both the heat and the acidity. So it kills coral reefs, which, you know, hold about 45% of the ocean life diversity. So this is actually serious. And so the whole idea is this: what are we going to do about it? And can we do anything about it? Now, we've been talking about decarbonization. I mean, I love it. Let's do it. Wonderful. We are not doing it. That is just the bottom line. Okay. CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are still rising. Global emissions of greenhouse gases are still rising. The use of fossil fuel is still rising. So all of our talk and all of the wind turbines we put in place and all that is not doing anything. And you got to remember that the numbers are huge, and it's all about the numbers. So again, you have almost 8 billion people. We produce 24 trillion kilowatt hours today. We're going to produce 35, 40 trillion kilowatt hours by 2040, 2050. It's still going up. And you might say, well, let's not keep increasing energy output. But you can't do that, okay? Because there's a dynamic tension between humans and the environment, right? Humans want to live. No big surprise there. Okay. They want their families to live. They want the children to live. They want to have a good life. Okay. They don't want to be rich or anything, but they want to have a good life. And that takes about 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year to do that. And it doesn't matter whether, you know, you were in the 1700s and you were getting that equivalent energy off the backs of slaves and indentured servants and oxen and horses. It's a great calculation for the student. But you know, nowadays we get it off of mainly fossil fuel with a little bit of other. And the thing is, if you don't have 3,000 to 6,000 kilowatt hours per person per year, then you are not going to have a good life. And in fact, when you get below about 1,000 kilowatt hours per person per year as a country, you're really in abject poverty. And most of your people spend 6 hours a day just getting water. Okay, so this is not a good thing. And the weird thing about poverty, it might not be intuitive, but poor humans are the worst environmental assault. Okay, they're worse in the environment than anything because they are starving. I mean, they're poor. And so they'll cut down all the trees because they need the firewood. They don't have, you know, oil and gas and coal to burn. They just don't have anything. So the idea that you want humans to have a good life, of course, and if they have to choose between the spotted owl and their children surviving, they're going to choose their children. I mean, this is not a big surprise. And unfortunately, a lot of people think that that's not the case because they have the luxury of having a good life already, and they don't think about what it's like to be. So there's still, you know, 1 billion people that have no access to energy whatsoever, electricity. There's 2.4 billion people that still burn wood manure as the main source of energy, and 3 billion more people are going to be born. And they all need energy, and they're all going to get it one way or another. The big trick here is to give it to them the right way that doesn't destroy the planet. Now, one thing that we didn't deal with like we were supposed to in the middle of the last century was population control. And so we've blown that. So again, we're going to get up to, you know, 10 billion probably people by mid-century. And the interesting thing about access to energy is if you have access to more than 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year, the birth rate drops to below 2. It is the best birth control there is access to energy. Because when you have that much energy, your thinking of the future changes completely. You're not living day to day. You actually believe you're going to live to age 40, and you believe your children are going to live to age 40. And therefore, the number of children born in that society drops precipitously. We've seen that in every developed country where it's all below two, you know, which is the replacement rate. In fact, replacement rate's about 2.1, 2.2 because of other causes of death. Okay. So you know, this is all bound up with that. It's all bound up with people, the number of people, the amount of energy we need to eradicate global poverty and its evil stepchildren, war and terrorism. If we don't do that, if we don't give this world almost 40 trillion kilowatt hours per person, I'm sorry, per year, 40 trillion kilowatt hours per year, then we are not going to eradicate poverty or war or terrorism. So that's kind of the goal. Now, to get there, is the big question, is the big trick. Fossil fuels are just so convenient. They're just a really nice source of energy, and they have been for 170 years. And we produce more of them. You know, America produces more fossil fuel of all types than anyone in the world. We have hundreds of years worth because we figured out how to frack, which is an amazing technology, although environmentally it sends shivers down your spine. We can get this stuff out of the ground so easy now, so cheaply, that the idea that we're not going to use it or that we're going to suddenly stop poor people from getting any is insane. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And we've seen that. It's not happening. That's why COP26 was a failure. COP21 was a failure, because we don't have a strategy for poor countries. We have a strategy for rich countries. You know, you can buy an EV or, compact fluorescence, LEDs. I mean, all this kind of stuff, eat veggie. I mean, that's fine if you have the luxury of a rich country, but you can't if you're not rich. And so we really need a plan for that. Now, one of the problems is all of the predictions for the amount of heating that's going to occur in the next 100 years is pretty dire. And it's also pretty quick. If you don't do something by 2040, everyone always talks about 2040, then forget it. I mean, you literally might as well not even try. Okay, I don't want to be pessimistic and weird and all that kind of thing, but I'm sorry. If you don't do anything.
Hang on for a second. So flesh that out just a little bit. If we don't make it by 2040, what?
Then so much CO2 is in the atmosphere that there's not much you can do about it. I mean, the heating will be at least 2.5 degrees C, if not 3, okay, or 4. Because the weird thing about CO2, as well as the other greenhouse gases, but their life span in the atmosphere is rather long. So you know what half-life is, right? Half-life, right. It's the amount of time till half of it's gone. It's not just radioactive, half-lives. There's biological half-lives, like, how long something stays in your body. There's chemical half-lives, how long a chemical stays in a system. And there's atmospheric half-life. So the atmospheric half-life of water is 3 days. Okay, so water goes up, it comes down, it goes in and out. It doesn't really do anything. It's a response gas or response vapor. Okay, so things heat up, more goes into the atmosphere, things cool off, water comes out of the atmosphere. CO2, on the other hand, has a half-life between 30 and 300 years. Half-life. Okay, so depending upon the mechanisms that it undergoes in the atmosphere photochemical reactions that go on there, the half-life at the shortest is 30 years. So that means if you don't stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, then you have to look, two or three half-lives out before you can have any significant drop. So we're already at the end of the century right now. Okay. So two half-lives is 90 years. And so, I'm sorry, three half-lives is 90 years. So if you keep putting CO2 into the atmosphere continuously, you never get to the point where you can start your half-life of it coming out. Okay. So in all projections, and I don't mean wishful thinking projections, I mean all projections of what's going to happen, has CO2 increasing in the atmosphere, emissions increasing until 2040. Increasing until 2040. Say so. No surcease. Okay. So what does that mean? It means that we can have all the COP26 meetings we want. We can cut all the coal plants in America we want, but it's not going to do anything.
So let's say we get to 2040 and the scenario that you're painting there. So what are some of the physical consequences on the Earth going to be at that point? At that point, and let's say looking forward from there.
Well, if global temperatures increase 2.5 to 3 degrees centigrade, then that moves all of your agricultural growing zones upwards. Okay, so what was zone 3 in California is now zone 2. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Russia loves this idea. Mm-hmm. Russia does not mind global warming at all, because their a lot of their land is going to become fertile. And Canada will do well too, but that's kind of beside the point. There's good and bad, but mostly it's bad, because most of the people do not live in northern climates, okay, that north. And so it'll, you'll have, sea level rise is a given, no matter what. But if you melt a significant amount of the Arctic and the Antarctic, then, sea level rises a fair amount, and you start drowning coastal cities, which, where most of the people live on Earth. There are island nations like, Seychelles and things like that, that are going away, and they're going away now. So there are consequences, and you might think, well, it's a slow enough change that you can deal with it. And a lot of people think that is correct. You can just deal with it, okay? Because of technology and because of things like growing food, the technology and farming practices, new farming practices are wonderful. We actually use less land to grow more food on. People don't understand that. There are places in Europe that are reforesting, okay, because they need less land to grow the food they need. Okay, that sounds great. So the idea that, we won't be able to grow food, that's not true. It'll just have to be grown in a different place and by different means. But we can adapt to some respect, all right? There's no question. Humans are adaptable. We're not going to go extinct. I mean, that's just not even possible. We're too ornery. we're too resourceful. Now, we might have a big dieback, which would be horrible. If a billion people die in the course of a few years, that will shake up the world and society as we know it. But those are doomsday scenarios. You don't want to really much get into that. Life is going to be rough, however, for billions of people. So just give that. Life has been getting better. Over time, life has been getting better for the world, no question about it. And if this goes unchecked, life will stop getting better for everyone in the world and will start getting worse for a fair number. And that's not something you want.
Yeah, so you have no need to ponder gloom and doom, as you say. But on the other hand, we do need to accept the fact that on our present trajectory, there's not a good outcome.
No. And in fact, we freak out when there's, a blackout, okay? Or when there's a significant tornado like there was this last weekend, or some storms or something. And that's pretty trivial compared to what we're talking about. So if we can't handle that, it's going to be pretty rough. Let's
pick it up from there in a sense. So I tend to agree with you that we talk a lot about reducing greenhouse gas emissions and the other related things, and we're just not doing it. The scientific data is just there very clearly that we're not addressing the problem in that kind of way. So we're going to talk about geoengineering today, and a geoengineering approach triggered by the fact that we're not addressing the greenhouse gas emissions, and there is a catastrophe out there waiting for us on our present track. So let's talk about geoengineering and start off by saying, okay, well, just what is geoengineering?
Okay, geoengineering is you doing something, humans doing something, to affect the atmosphere itself. So you're kind of messing with the atmosphere, and of course, people get upset when they think about that, because they think, wow, we're going to mess with the atmosphere. Isn't that dangerous? It's like, no. Wait a second. We've been messing with the atmosphere for 150 years in a very bad way. And no one seems to care much about that. So there are different things that we can do to try to reverse the effects of global warming by physically doing something to the Earth or to the atmosphere. So let me kind of go over those. The first one is carbon capture and removal and sequestration from the atmosphere. Okay, that's the easy one. And this is just geoengineering. Solar geoengineering is geoengineering applied to solar radiation. So we'll get to that. So just geoengineering in general is that you can try to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. They can do that with new technologies that actually absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. They're not advanced yet. They're not mature. And again, the numbers are huge. I mean, it takes an awful lot of of whatever technology you're going to use to take out the trillions and quadrillions of tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. Okay, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's staggering to think that you're going to take out CO2, which is only in the, you know, hundreds of part per million range. So the lower the concentration, the more difficult it is to get it out. But we have those technologies. There's a company called Carbon Engineering, and you know, they've done it. That's fine. Now, when you take it out of the atmosphere, what do you do with it? Okay, so one, you can turn it into fuel using different chemical techniques, and that's fine. It takes energy to do that. Or you can sequester it in the ground, which is not going to happen because we've learned, okay, people still think we're going to put it in the ground. And I know as a geologist that doesn't work very well. It causes earthquakes. It, you know, it's hard to find a place to put it. But again, there's some interesting technologies out there. Pacific Northwest Laboratory up here where I am had a way of sequestering it in basalt and make it precipitate out as a calcium carbonate mineral. Now, this is important because when you take CO2 out of the atmosphere, it's a gas, and gas is very dispersed, right? So you have to, you know, get it down there. The deeper you put it in the ground, the more the pressure compresses it, so smaller it gets. But if you put it into a mineral, then you're 1,000 times less voluminous, and you can put in a whole bunch of CO2 in the underground if you get it in as a mineral. But that's difficult. Again, it takes a lot of effort because you're talking about the volumes that are so huge. And so that's, you know, but people still work on that.
Okay, so let me just ask real quick here. So to me, the issue is, and you've pointed to this issue, the issue is the scale. So can you, so there are a couple plants around that are taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So if we were to make, okay, let's just say if we were just to keep up with the present production of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, how many of those plants would it take around the world and how much would that cost?
Yeah, like $70,000 in a trillion dollars. I mean, 70,000 in a trillion dollars.
Okay.
I mean, that's a lot. You know, it's not trivial. It's not a trivial thing.
Okay.
And that's, so, you know, but okay, we need to look at everything. I mean, I'm a scientist, so I, you know, just do it to try everything. Have someone working on every single one of these, okay, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing, of course, you know, reforestation. And reforestation is great. It's a slow thing, although there are now drones that drop seed pods that are filled with both water and nutrients. And so they, you know, they just drop them by the millions, and that works very nicely. But again, you got to do it, and it takes people to do that. The other thing is you can, there are some very kind of wacko things that I do not like.
Excuse me for a second, but I just want to back once again, I'm really interested in the whole scale thing. So, planting forests sounds great. What kind of scale are we talking about in terms of having a significant impact?
Well, everything that we've clear cut, which is, you know, most all the pristine forests in the world, you got to reforest those and they have to grow at least like 40, 50 years in order to sequester enough carbon in the wood. Okay, so yeah, this is, you know, yeah, that's not trivial.
just as a side fact, there's only 7% of the forests in the United States that are still in their original condition. So we're basically talking about we've cut it all down and starting all, yeah. if we were doing this, we'd just be sort of starting all over.
Right, right. And you have to, they have to be big trees. I mean, you can't have little sticks that, you know, it is in a cornfield. So again, but you want to do that because that is absolutely the best way of getting, you know, that's what nature does. That's how nature gets CO2 out of the atmosphere is by growing forests. But again, so you're looking out 40, 50 years, you know, 60 years, all of this stuff I'm going to talk about, you're going to see that essentially we're talking about 60, 70 years before it becomes effective. That's not good enough. Okay. So what you have to do is we need to buy time for all those things to take effect, to occur. And we'll eventually get to that. That's the solar geoengineering part, buys you time. Then there's other things like, you know, seeding the oceans with iron. It's like bad. That is not a technology I would feel comfortable with at all. Then you get to the solar geoengineering things. that's like cloud brightening. So the more clouds you have, the more it reflects solar incident radiation, and the more you don't heat up, okay, the more you actually cool off. So we know how to make clouds. We know how to see clouds. We've actually done that. It's very similar technology to putting snow on ski slopes. You know, you have these little nozzles and it comes out really fine particulates and it freezes. You know, it's the same technology. You just go up in the air and you start doing this. You take water. You actually have ships that take water and put it into these nozzles high up in the atmosphere, and you start making clouds. Now, clouds are tough to control because they're in the lower atmosphere, you know, the troposphere. And so, you know, you can't really control them. You just kind of put them up there and hope it works. Then the other thing is, in the stratosphere, in the upper atmosphere, okay, that is much more controllable because that is much more generalized around the globe. It's much better mixed. And so we know as a geologist from geologic history and from what we've seen in human history, large volcanoes like Pinatubo or Krakatoa, when they go off, they shoot a bunch of particulates high into the stratosphere. It has to go up above 15 miles, okay, to be effective this way. Otherwise, it falls back down and doesn't stay up there. So it gets into the stratosphere and it starts getting, you know, moved around the Earth, and you pretty much get a layer of dust particles that reflects light. And every time we have a huge volcanic eruption like that, it cools the Earth off about 2 degrees for about 3 years, okay, as all of that's dropping out mainly over the oceans. So you know, we know this works. I mean, it absolutely works. You put stuff in the stratosphere, it'll, you know, depending on how much and what kind of particles, it'll reflect sunlight for a couple of years till it comes out. So you have to keep putting it up there. Okay, as because it keeps coming out after a couple of years. Now, volcanoes put up a bunch of crap. I mean, they put up, you know, soot and sulfur and all this nonsense. And people have been talking about injecting those. It's like, no, you don't need to inject those. You don't need to, you know, you just need to find the right materials, something like mother of pearl, which is, you know, just ground up, you know, clamshells and things like that. And those are highly reflective, but they're not nasty like sulfur particles. And when they come out of the ocean, they actually can affect the ocean acidification issue because they're carbonate. So that's the kind of material I would use. People are looking at this, and this is a research, a fundamental research area. It's led by David Keith at Harvard and by Tom Ackerman at University of Washington. And the problem is there's not a lot of funding in it. And the interesting thing is it is incredibly cheap. I mean, when you think about, you know, putting stuff into the atmosphere continuously for, you know, 90 years to give us time to all this other stuff to work and for us to decarbonize and get ourselves off of fossil fuel, because that's what it's going to take, then it's incredibly cheap. It's kind of funny. And the research is incredibly cheap. Now, let's see. We've done calculations how much it would cost to decarbonize America, okay, to get off of fossil fuel, okay, in the next 20 years. It would cost about $9 trillion, and $4 trillion of that is capital investment.
So when we're talking about decarbonizing, we're talking about replacing fossil fuel energy with some other kinds of energy.
Right, with renewables, nuclear, hydro, gotcha, the whole bit. And also, you know, other technological fixes that don't require a new energy source, but it's just, you know, useful. But, you know, so we're talking about the trillion. We're talking about over $10 trillion. Now, for the world to decarbonize, it's going to cost $65 trillion. And it's going to, you know, $28 trillion of that is capital investment. Okay, so these are big numbers. Now, we just passed a $1 trillion, you know, infrastructure bill, and everyone, wow, wow, wow. Well, $1 trillion is going to cut it. And of that $1 trillion, I don't know, there's maybe $100 billion for climate change, if that.
Yeah. And I would just like to make the point quickly too, what you're talking about decarbonizing, all that does is stop making things worse.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
It does not fix the problem.
Yeah. It doesn't fix the problem. It just stops making it worse. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So again, you need to do that. Okay. That's fine. But you need time to do that. Because it's not going to happen by 2040, but it could happen by 2100. You know, really, mm-hmm. really could. And then the sequestration could happen by 2100. It really could. So when you talk about decarbonizing, though, you're talking about multiple trillions of dollars right. for the world. You know, $65 trillion or so.
Yeah.
Right. Now, to do solar geoengineering, just to do the research to find out what kind of particles, how much to put in there, where to put them in, you know, what kind of local effects are going to happen. We cost like, you know, $100 million a year for 10 years. I mean, that's $1 billion. That's nothing.
This is just for the research.
Just for the research to get it down so you know what you're doing. And the other thing about solar geoengineering is, you know, it fixes itself really quickly. If you don't like what happened, if you say, oh my God, we put in too much particulates, well, just wait a year, you know, and half of it's going to come out. So it's not like you've locked yourself into some future. And so that's what you need to do. Now, once you figure out the material you want to use, how much, you know, how often, we have the technology to do it. We already do that. Okay. We have the technology to insert material into the stratosphere. It's not that difficult, not that expensive. In fact, you're talking about $1 to $10 billion a year. Okay. So, you know, that's a lot better than 60 trillion.
Right. It's nickels and dimes.
It's right. And so the idea that we can do this, and to give ourselves time, because what that does is depending on how much you put in and how often you put it in, you can adjust whatever temperature you want. You can put it back to the 1850, you know, baseline. You can put it back to 1950 temperature. You can put it, you know, whatever. You can stop it right where it is now. I mean, you actually have control of this, and you can put the temperature pretty much where you want it.
Okay, let's just hang on right there for one quick second. So you said you have control. So, okay, let's talk about who is this you that we're talking about.
Ah, yes. Whose hand is going to be on the thermostat? So again, you know, hey, let's look at the United Nations. Wow, they do a bang up job of all this kind of stuff, right? I don't mean to be sarcastic, but it's going to take, you know, the United Nations would be a great place to try to talk about this. Now, as you know, though, making decisions on something like this is going to be pretty rough because it's going to be the rich countries that do it. All right, it's going to be the poor countries that benefit from it or don't benefit, depending on if it doesn't work. But certainly the poor countries are the ones that are going to at disadvantage now and are going to suffer the most. So we should do it. Fine. Now, China has actually said they might just do it regardless of what anyone else says. Okay. And what can you do to stop them? What are you going to do? Bomb them? I mean, you know, we're going to go to war because someone is putting something into the stratosphere. I mean, so again, it's kind of before anything happens, however, you have to do the research. And the research is not that expensive, and it's something we have long been ignoring.
Well, I hear you turning away from the topic, which is understandable enough because it's a tough question. But
yes.
So we just want to put out there, we need to acknowledge, I think, that individual countries, because you say it's relatively inexpensive, it's easy, and the science all presently exists, individual countries, it would be well within their means to say, okay, it's too hot here. We're sick of it. We're going with solar geoengineering. And as I think about this, it seems like doing what we're talking about is even within the reach of individuals. I mean, we've got guys.
Bill Gates could do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So.
No question. Yeah, but again, it's you don't want to do it. Even countries that might feel desperate and just want to do it, you're not going to do it until you do the research to tell you how much, where, when, you know, that kind of thing. So you got to do the research first, and that is something that countries can do. I mean, Bill Gates can't do that research.
Yeah.
So you need to fund the research groups around the country. There's like five or six of them that are good at this, but especially Harvard, especially UW, University of Washington. So you know, just do that. You got to do that. You can't get started on this because even if China decides to do it, they're not going to do it without knowing what they're doing. Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
I see the reasoning and the appeal of solar geoengineering. And if it's going to happen, really there, I don't see that anybody in the world, any country in the world is in a position to stop it from happening if some other country decides to do it. So it almost has the feel of kind of a global wild, wild west where because some countries are going to benefit and some countries are going to suffer as a result of solar geoengineering, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and indeed. And so yeah, though, but it's not any different than any other issue like mining the oceans or, you know, oil drilling on, you know, in all over the world. I mean, you know, it's hurt some countries, it's helped some countries, that kind of thing. So it's just one of those things. The thing that's different is that there's no immediate financial benefit to any one person or group. I mean, you know, it's not like someone is going to, oh, I'm going to do this because I'm going to make $1 billion. That's not going to happen. Okay. The beneficiaries are many people broadly placed around the world. So it's, you know, so it really is an altruistic kind of thing. You have to want to do this to help the planet. Now, if you say, well, of course, you know, China's going to suffer, so China's going to do this, or, you know, I get that. India's going to suffer, so India's, you know, is going to do this. That's simply a motivation for them to do it. It isn't guaranteed that they're going to do it. So it's one of those things that benefits from coordination and cooperation. One of the few things, okay, that benefits from that. So I see that as possible. Now, of course, one of the big things that people say is, oh my God, then it'll just give us an excuse not to decarbonize. And it's like, no, that is such a trivial consideration compared to actually stopping global warming. I mean, it's like, okay, some people might think of that, fine, but the problem is if you don't decarbonize, you're going to be doing this forever. Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, it does not make any sense. And for the long term too, I mean, someone might do that for 10 years, but then, you know, they're out of the, you know, they're out of the mainstream by then, or 20 years or something like that. So it's not that there's this cabal of people around the world just waiting for an excuse,
right,
to not decarbonize.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The fossil fuel industry doesn't want to decarbonize now, but if they're given, you know, not given a choice, if they say we're going to decarbonize. I mean, right now we're trying to get everyone to decarbonize. All this is doing is giving us time because, yeah, like we're saying, there's no way it's going to happen in time to fix things. So what are your alternatives? Well, keep decarbonizing and just give us, you know, an extra 60 years by doing solar geoengineering.
Yeah. So aspects of this conversation at the imponderables, let's call it, about how things actually play out, it's starting to have a little bit of a feel of a college dorm room conversation to me in a way, because one of the things I'm seeing is that, I mean, you've already pointed out, and it's very clear that it seems as a species, at least so far, it's been completely impossible for us to get together and come up with a viable plan. We have no viable plan, and most of what we are seeing is talk, and people are just doing what they're doing. And, you know, so I have to ask myself, what's the likelihood of that that's going to change? And if it doesn't change, then we're going to just have, there's going to be no global plan, and we're going to have individual actors acting in their best interest, and
right,
it's just the wild, wild west that I was talking about.
Right, right. But agreed, except if the research isn't done, there's no way that India is going to start firing stuff up into the stratosphere without knowing what's going to happen.
Yep.
I mean, without having any modeling or any, you know, any
so your
experimental
key, so,
results.
Okay, so I'm getting your key point. Your key point is not so much that we should do this or how we're going to do it. It's you want to figure out, okay, what are the ramifications? How do we get it up there? You want to know what the science is, and you're advocating for financial and political support for research on solar geoengineering.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah. So what I've heard a lot of pushback is, you know, this is like an emergency room tactic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the patient came in with a gunshot wound and they're bleeding to death, and you just do whatever you can to stop
right,
it, okay?
Right.
So that's fine. You know, the preventive care, you know, the wellness the wellness program for the patient, you know, is a good diet and that kind of thing. However, if it comes with a gunshot wound, you don't go up and say, you need to change your diet. Okay, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So you have to have the emergency room protocols in place in case you need them. Okay. And so when it becomes obvious that we need them, that's not the time to do the research. That's not the time to have,
yeah,
you know, protocols in place. So you need to do it in the next 20 years, because by 2040, it's going to become very obvious that we will not be decarbonized by 2040. So you need to have this in place. And again, this can be that once you do the research over 10 years or so, you can start it right away, and it'll be effective that next year.
Yep. Okay. So, politically speaking, then, where are we right now in the United States, in particular, and possibly in the world in general? Where are we in terms of support for this kind of research?
Very little. You know, $10 million. You know, $20 million, kind of thing. Not much. Okay. You need, you know, $100 million a year focused at, you know, key places like Harvard and UW to get this done.
So why is there so little political interest in researching solar geoengineering?
Oh, just like any scientific issue, politicians have either not heard of it or heard of it and laughed, right? They've heard of it and laughed. It's like, you know, it's like a science fiction movie. And they're not going to give it any credibility unless someone with credibility suggests it to them.
So. Yeah. Well, it seems like it's a part of our nature as human beings that we'd rather deal with messes than prevent the mess in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to see if I can sum up real quickly here in layperson kind of terms what you're sketching out here. I mean, first of all, it's real clear that we're not doing anywhere near an adequate job of addressing greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. And we look downstream, and the likelihood that we start doing that also seems pretty unlikely to me. So what you're asking for is to at least have this tool in our toolkit that we've done the research on in time that we can use if things get to the point where we say, okay, we're in the emergency room, the patient is in dire straits, and we need to do something right now. You're not offering it as a replacement for decarbonizing. You're saying, okay, give us some time. Eventually, we will be able to do it, but we're not going to be able to do it by 2040 or 2050. So is that a fair layperson summary?
That's perfect. Yep. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. So, yeah, if I were in your class, I'd take that as I'm doing all right in your class. So anything else you want to add on solar geoengineering in particular, Jim, as we finish up here?
No, that's pretty much it. You got to do the research, you got to be ready to do it, and then you have then think about the politics of how to do it, how to coordinate it around the world. But again, it's so cheap that it's not like, you know, you have to get buy-in from every country and support, like, you know, COP26 is trying to get, you know, $10 billion here and $10 billion there to try to help decarbonizing. It's like, that's not, no, I mean, we could do it easily. I mean, you know, we could do it with the error in the military budget. It's like, you know, it's just incredible.
Okay. Well, I, you know, you've made somewhat of a believer out of me. I see the, like so many things, the detail, the nuance is the most important part. You know, it's real easy to throw rocks or put your arms around a big picture, you know, say, well, we'll just use green energy. But the issue was in the nuance of it. So, Jim, I really appreciate you taking the time with us today. And thanks for all you do.
Thank you so much. It's a great subject.
So there you have it. It was great talking with Dr. Konka. It seems so clear that we are not, as a species, looking into the future with a clear-eyed and coherent way of managing fossil fuel pollution, our unsustainable agricultural processes, etc. How it's all going to play out, who knows? But one thing I am pretty confident of is that better informed we are, the more clear-eyed our perspective is, the more likely it is that we will successfully mitigate and adapt to our changing climate environment here and all around the world. Always good to hear from you. You can drop me a note at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. The CCL is for Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a good outfit. Check it out, ccltacoma.org. And just a reminder that this and all other locally produced programming is available on the internet. Just do a search for KTAH and you'll look under programming and you'll find the archive of this and other programs right there. So that's it for today. Here I am, as always, reminding you to live like the mountain is out. Take care now.